Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 369, titled Either Kashmir or Palestine. This is being recorded on July 15th of the year 2002. What we're going to be looking at in this next half hour is some of the history of Islamofascism. Specifically, we're going to be taking a look at author John Roy Carlson's reportings on some of the development of Islamofascism as of the early 1950s. Again, this program is being recorded on July 15th of 2002. By Islamofascism, I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but there is a very powerful fascist element, a theocratic fascist element within Islam, and that element, in combination with powerful business forces, including those associated with the petroleum industry, and in cooperation with the economic forces of the Underground Reich, is one of the major factors behind September 11th. To make September 11th, make a long story short, I believe that it is the most tangible element in what is quite literally a war, an economic, political, and military struggle between the United States and the Underground Reich and its Islamo-fascist allies. One of the keys to understanding the line of argument that I'm presenting in these broadcasts is to understand the Nazi geopolitical concept of the Earth Island. The Nazi geopoliticians took a look at the world and they saw a giant landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, incorporating the former Soviet Union, the Middle East, most of the world's petroleum-producing regions, India, China, and Pakistan. They saw the key to controlling that landmass as controlling the Muslim population that stretched across the middle of it, and in turn they saw that control as dominating most of the world's landmass and its petroleum reserves and as the key to controlling the world. That concept and the concept of using the Islamic peoples of the world for their purposes represents the key to understanding the Islamo-fascist element in geopolitics. Understanding some of the connections between the Bormann Organization and between elements of the American business and financial elite, including the genesis of the Bush family, which I believe to be the point element for the Bormann Organization in the United States, and understanding the Bush family's business heritage with the Third Reich is another element in understanding the development of this relationship. We've taken a look at the law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. That was the law firm of the Dulles brothers, Alan and John Foster Dulles. It played a key role in arranging the financing of the Third Reich. It also has played a key role in world affairs since that time. It represents the Saudi bin Laden group, the bin Laden family construction monopoly. It also was walking point in a recent effort by American financial institutions to weaken the Treasury Department's oversight regulations with regard to money laundering and the financing of international terrorism. The Dulles brothers' power peaked in the 1950s when John Foster was made Secretary of State under Eisenhower at the same time as his brother Alan became director of the CIA. And we took a look at the genesis of Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabi sect, the fact that Alan Dulles, King Ibn Saud, and Jack Philby, a British spy and Nazi espionage agent, who, along with Alan Dulles and Ibn Saud, was at the very foundation of the Wahhabi-slash-Saudi state. Mohammed bin Laden's father, or Osama bin Laden's father, Mohammed bin Laden, was a close friend of Ibn Saud and got his start in business in this very same time period. It's very interesting in light of that the Saudi bin Laden group is represented by Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles law firm. By way of taking a look at some of the history of the Earth Island and some of the genesis of some of the things, some of the powerful forces that have precipitated the events of September 11th, we're going to take a look at the book Forbidden Truth, subtitled U.S. Taliban, Secret Oil Diplomacy, and the Failed Hunt for Bin Laden. This book was co-authored by Jean-Charles Brizard and Guillaume Dasquet, published in softcover by Thunder's Mouth Press, Nation Books, again, copyright 2002 in softcover. ISBN number 1-56025-414-9. According to the book Forbidden Truth, the genesis of the Saudi bin Laden group actually predates the formal founding of Saudi Arabia as a, well, I couldn't call it a modern state, as a Concrete Nation. That took place formally in 1932. According to Forbidden Truth, Saudi Bin Laden Group actually had its genesis in 1931. It was in precisely this time period that not only many of the economic relationships connecting elements of Wall Street with the Third Reich, those relationships went right through in the modern period through the Bormann Organization, but in turn, some of the connections between some of those same Western economic interests and the petroleum industry and the Saudi/Wahhabi state. The founding of Saudi Bin Laden Group takes place in exactly this same time period. Forbidden Truth describes the genesis of Saudi Bin Laden Group. The Bin Laden family's economic and financial empire was founded in the early part of the 20th century by its patriarch, Muhammad Awad. Born in Hadramaut in Yemen, he moved to Saudi Arabia in 1928 and settled there. From very early on, the family was closely connected to King Abd al-Aziz, that's King Ibn Saud, and involved in the emergence and formation of the Wahhabi kingdom. It was the king who helped the Bin Ladens start their business by hiring them to do the construction work on the part of the royal palace, and later exclusively giving them the job of renovating the holy sites in Mecca and Medina. This mutual trust gave the family hope for success in a kingdom that had yet to be developed. Again, Saudi Arabia formally came into being in 1932. Continuing, in 1931, Mohammed bin Laden founded the Saudi Bin Laden Group, SBG, or Bin Laden Organization, in Jeddah, and it quickly became one of the kingdom's leading companies. Its close ties to the Saudi rulers also explain why the family's business affairs were rarely decided by the ministries or during official meetings. There were no formal offers for the Bin Ladens. Instead, contracts were drawn up directly by the king's personal secretary and authorized by royal decree. For several years, the group had been the official and exclusive contractor for the kingdom's holy sites, as well as for Jerusalem's holy sites, until 1967. And so again, note the genesis of Saudi Bin Laden Group in 1931, a year before Saudi Arabia itself came into being. Now, by way of looking at some of the history of Islamofascism, as I call it, and again, I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but there's a very powerful fascist element within it. We're going to be taking a look at a remarkable book called Cairo to Damascus. It's authored by John Roy Carlson, a prominent anti-fascist writer whose best-known work was the book Undercover, published in 1943. John Roy Carlson's Undercover was followed by his book The Plotters, which was published in the immediate post-World War II period. In 1952, Alfred A. Knopf and Company published a book called Cairo to Damascus, and John Roy Carlson, again the nom de plume for Arthur Derunian, an Armenian-American, whose work, by the way, we've accessed in For the Record number 182. Arthur Derunian traveled under an alias in the Middle East and basically gave his reportage on Islamofascism. His book was published again in 1952 by Alfred A. Knopf and Company, and Cairo to Damascus was copyright 1951 by John Roy Carlson. The Library of Congress, or ISBN, number is 51-11068. In the book Cairo to Damascus, John Roy Carlson, among other factors, discusses, among other elements, discusses the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, a major in the SS who recruited several Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions, including the 13th Waffen-SS, composed of Bosnian Muslims, and the 21st Waffen-SS. 13th Waffen-SS was Hanjar. 21st Waffen-SS was called the Skanderbeg Division, composed of Kosovar Albanians. The Grand Mufti was a key Axis spy, and after World War II, he went underground. He fled the wrath of the Allied powers and turned up in, among other places, Karachi, Pakistan. And he is described here. Now, bear in mind, again, this book was published in 1952. It's a half century old. The book is discussing events that took place in February of 1951. And as we take a look back at the Grand Mufti and what he was doing in 1951, we can see some interesting echoes and historical lessons for today. What the Mufti was doing was presiding over the World Muslim Congress, which later went on to become a key element of the World Anti-Communist League and was a key element of Western policy in the so-called Golden Crescent. It was heavily involved with the anti-Soviet Afghan support effort in the 1980s. The World Muslim Congress representing an element of continuity from the Grand Mufti's efforts in the immediate post-World War II era, right on up through the 1980s that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda as warriors. And bearing in mind the concept of the Earth Island that I've spoken about and among other programs for the record 365 and 366, listen to the following. Speaking of the Grand Mufti, John Roy Carlson writes, in February 1951, he suddenly reappeared in Karachi, Pakistan, to meet old friends who had supported his cause in Iraq and to preside over a 12-day World Muslim Congress. In a typical inflammatory address, he called for a full struggle, unquote, by the Muslims, again quoting, to meet the aggressor, meaning in this instance the non-Muslim Hindus of India. He assured the delegates, quote, we shall meet next with sword in hand on the soil of either Kashmir or Palestine, unquote. That again, the Grand Mufti writing talking in 1951 to the World Muslim Congress, a key element of the Afghan anti-Soviet Afghan support effort of the 1980s. Note the reference to Iraq. We're going to talk about the Grand Mufti and his role in setting up an anti-British pro-Axis rebellion in Iraq in 1941. One of the key officers involved in that was a fellow named Khairullah al-Tufah, the uncle and political mentor of Saddam Hussein and the person who headed up Saddam Hussein's biological warfare program that called the Department of Veterinary Affairs. First, we're going to take a look at John Roy Carlson's personal interview with Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, a key Islamo-fascist organization that underlies al-Qaeda, according to many accounts, and that is a principal element in the al-Taqwa network that we've looked at before. One of the people who also overlaps the al-Taqwa network is Talat Atman, a director of Harkin Energy, the Bush Oil Company, that has recently been in the news. In the early 1950s, John Roy Carlson interviewed Hassan al-Banna, the founder and leader or supreme guide of the Muslim Brotherhood, also a member of the board of directors, as we looked at in For the Record 359, of al-Taqwa, that described in Salon Magazine's issue of March 15th of 2002. Speaking of Hassan al-Banna, John Roy Carlson writes, all that I had learned about Hassan al-Banna and the unquestioned loyalty he inspired in his cutthroats only whetted my desire to meet him. It proved more difficult than I expected because of his deep hatred of Europeans. Finally, one day, accompanied by my friend Gamal, I walked into Ikhwan headquarters for my audience with the Supreme Guide. Skipping down. And he then quotes the Murshid, or Supreme Guide. The Quran should be Egypt's constitution, for there is no law higher than Quranic law, the Murshid began, again quoting, we seek to fulfill the lofty human message of Islam, which has brought happiness and fulfillment to mankind in centuries past. Ours is the highest ideal, the holiest cause, and the purest way. Those who criticize us have fed from the tables of Europe. They want to live as Europe has taught them, to dance, to drink, to revel, to mix the sexes openly and in public. By the way, echoes of the Taliban here, or rather it could be said that the Taliban were echoes of the Muslim Brotherhood. And as we looked at in For the Record 343 and 351, it would appear that the Taliban in many ways represented a concretization of the Muslim Brotherhood. Note next that John Roy Carlson took note of the fact that Hassan al-Banna's desire for a worldwide Muslim theocracy extended to the United States. I asked his views on establishing the caliphate, the complete merger of church and state, the Muslim equivalent of religious totalitarianism as in Spain. We want an Arabian United States with a caliphate at its head and every Arab state subscribing wholeheartedly to the laws of the Quran. We must return to the Quran, which preaches the good life, which forbids us to take bribes, to cheat, to kill one's brother. The laws of the Quran are suitable for all men at all times to the end of the world. This is the day, and this is the time when the world needs Islam most. I could not help making a mental note that the word Christian had been similarly used and with similar fanaticism among Western exponents of authoritarianism. By the way, the Hassan al-Banna is proposing a united Arab state, the United States of Arabia, under Islam here. The Grand Mufti also extended his message, his pro-Axis anti-American message, to American Muslims. Continuing. We are not eager to have a parliament of or the representatives. We are not eager to have a parliament of the representatives of the people, the Supreme Guide continued, or a cabinet of ministers, unless such representatives and ministers are Quranic Muslims. If we do not find them, then we must serve ourselves as the parliament. Allah and the religious councils will limit our authority so that no one has to fear dictatorship. We aim to smash modernism in government and society. In Palestine, our first duty as Muslims is to crush Zionism, which is Jewish modernism. It is our patriotic duty. The Quran commands it. Unquote. He was silent and then nodded to indicate that the interview was over. That, again, echoes of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the views thereof, the Muslim Brotherhood, which in many ways is one of the springboards for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and heavily involved with Al-Taqwa. What we're going to look at next concerns some of the Yugoslav pro-Axis Muslim formations that we spoke about earlier. We've spoken in, among other programs, for the record, 338, and 340 and 341 about the continuity between the Balkan Muslim Waffen SS formations and elements associated with Al-Qaeda slash bin Laden, particularly through the Arab Afghans. What we're going to look at here concerns the fact that some of the pro-Axis, pro-Nazi veterans of World War II from the Muslim Waffen SS formations or associated with them also recoalesced, so to speak, reappeared in the Middle East, fighting with the Arab Legion on behalf of the Grand Mufti against the fledgling forces of Israel. One of those veterans here is a fellow named Stefan Meyer, who was interviewed by John Roy Carlson. Speaking of Stefan Meyer, he had been caught by the English on a submarine off Italy and imprisoned in various camps. Finally, he and another German, a captain of the Wehrmacht, had escaped. They had been fighting with the Arabs since then. He and other Germans had fought in Kataman in Jerusalem, confirming Israeli disclosures that instructions had been found there in German. I noted that Stefan was well-dressed and smoked expensive cigarettes. Apparently his funding came from someone other than the Arabs. One suspects here probably underground Reich elements in this context. Quote, I don't receive money from any Arabs. Someone else gives it when I need it. Unquote, he said, again quoting, You will meet many Germans here. We have headquarters here and in Beirut. There are also many Yugoslav Muslims here. Some of them are living in a mosque. I will introduce you to them. Yugoslavs and Germans are everywhere in the Syrian army. And still later, yet another element of continuity between the Balkan Muslim Waffen SS formations and the Arab legions fighting against Israel in this part of the world at this time was described by John Roy Carlson. This is a fellow named Kiel Zanovich. Turning once again to Cairo to Damascus, after Stefan's glowing introduction, Kiel became friendly. He told me he had served under Nazi General Hans Guderian and fought in Smolensk and Stalingrad. Later, he had joined Quisling Pavlich. By the way, Ante Pavlich was the head of the Ustashi in Nazi-dominated Croatia. Returning again to Carlson's account, Kiel was a career militarist and an expert trainer and technician and was engaged in that capacity in the Syrian army. And again, Kiel was yet another person coordinating many of the Yugoslav Muslims and the Germans, German veterans of the Third Reich, in the Arab legions that were commanded by the Grand Mufti and that fought against Israel in its War of Independence in 1948. As I'm speaking on July 15th of 2002, there has been a great deal of sword rattling in the direction of Saddam Hussein. One of the aspects of Saddam Hussein's political heritage that has not received a great deal of discussion, but that I think falls directly into the factors of maneuvering here between what I have called the Underground Reich and its Islamo-fascist and secular Arabo-fascist allies, is the fact that Saddam Hussein's political heritage and that of the Ba'ath Party go directly back to Nazi Germany. The Ba'ath Party, which split between its Syrian and Iraqi factions, in many ways takes the Nazi Party of Germany as its inspiration. And specifically, it was a pro-Nazi, anti-British uprising in Iraq in 1941, led by the Grand Mufti and financed by Nazi Germany, that saw the genesis of Khairullah al-Tufah, that is Saddam Hussein's uncle, and his political mentor, who was openly pro-Nazi and took part in this abortive Grand Mufti rebellion in 1941. Khairullah al-Tufah, in addition to being Saddam Hussein's political mentor and his uncle, also headed up the Iraqi Biological Warfare Development Program, as we've looked at, and among other programs, for the record, 287 and 295. That program was called the Department of Veterinary Affairs, and I would note that as of mid-2001, one of the things they had apparently developed was foot and mouth disease, and there was an outbreak of that in Britain. That strain was native to the Middle East and to India and Pakistan. It had never been seen before in Europe. I wonder to what extent that might have actually been a biological warfare attack by Iraq. I wonder to what extent that might have something to do with the saber rattling that has taken place in the direction of Iraq since that time. Certainly, I think the evidence linking Iraq with September 11th is ambiguous, but I wonder about the South Asian strain of foot and mouth, which was being developed by the Department of Veterinary Affairs, and I wonder that was the Iraqi BW program. I wonder about its appearance in Britain at that time and the subsequent saber rattling. Now, about the pro-Nazi revolt in Iraq in 1941 and the Grand Mufti's role in that, we read as follows in From Cairo to Damascus. Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti, spent 2 years as a fugitive in Lebanon and Syria, then suddenly turned up in Baghdad, where Iraq's pro-German Arabs vied with one another to entertain him. The Iraqi parliament voted him a grant of $72,000. He received funds from the Iraqi Secret Service. Under a check-off system, all Iraqi officials and civil servants paid him a percentage of their salaries. Funds flowed in from various political and charitable groups. Gifts were received from Egypt and King Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia. By the way, note that one of his good friends and allies at this point was Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father. Continuing. The Mufti was also financed heavily by the Nazis and the Italians. Haji Amin lavished huge funds on the men he had placed in office and gained enormous influence over Iraqi officials, army generals, and police chiefs. He controlled major appointments. He whipped up Axis sentiment among the illiterate and fanatical masses for a jihad against the Allied cause, and otherwise perfected his fifth column machine. Against this background, Axis propaganda itself was intensified. Germany was set up as a savior to the Muslim world, unquote, and Hitler was touted as a, quote, descendant of the prophet, unquote. The enemy, Germany was set up as a savior to the Muslim world, and Hitler was touted as a descendant of the prophet, the enemy of the Jews and the British, the protector of Islam, unquote, who is devoting himself to the establishment of an Arab federation free from British control. Serving as virtually the uncrowned king of Iraq, the Mufti was now ready to write Hitler proposing collaboration in all spheres as follows. Arabian nationalism owes Your Excellency much gratitude and recognition for the fact that you raised the Palestinian question repeatedly in public addresses. I should like to thank Your Excellency again at this opportunity and to reassure you, Your Excellency, on the feelings of friendship, sympathy, and admiration which the Arabian people devote to Your Excellency, great leader and the courageous German people. By the way, he's talking to Hitler here, and this is in a formal address to Hitler. Continuing, I take this opportunity to delegate my private secretary to the German government so that, in the name of the strongest and largest Arabian organization, as well as in my own name, he may initiate the negotiations necessary for a sincere and loyal collaboration in all spheres. In reply to this letter, Hitler's Secretary of State, Freiherr von Weizsäcker, wrote, The Führer has read your detailed report on the national struggle of the Arabs with great interest and sympathy, and was pleased with the friendly words which you addressed to him in the name of Arab nationalism. I am authorized to inform you of the following. In agreement with your request, Germany is ready and willing to collaborate with you if an effort to attain your national goal should be impelled to fight against England, to grant you military and financial support within the limits of the possible. In order to aid the Arabs in their preparations for a possible conflict with England, Germany is further prepared to supply them immediately with war materials if a way can be found to transport them. I beg that this letter be kept secret. The Italian government has been informed of its contents and is in agreement with it. Skipping down. On April 21, 1941, under the Mufti's direction, the Iraqi politician Rashid Ali el-Kailani, with the aid of generals controlling the army, staged a coup against the Iraq government, forced the regent to flee, and made himself prime minister. King Farouk of Egypt and Riyad el-Soul, later Lebanon's prime minister, sent messages of encouragement. Forthwith, the Mufti issued a fatwa, the summons to a holy war. In the name of merciful and almighty Allah, I invite all my Muslim brothers throughout the whole world to join in the holy war for Allah, for the defense of Islam and her lands against her enemy. O faithful, obey and respond to my call. I invite you, O brothers, to join in the war for Allah and preserve Islam, your independence, and your lands from English aggression. I invite you to bring all your weight to bear in helping Iraq that she may throw off the shame that torments her. O heroic Iraq, Allah is with thee, the Arab nation and the Muslim world are solidly with thee in thy holy struggle. Unquote. It was a critical hour for the Allies. With Iraq in Nazi hands, the next Axis step would be to cut off the Allies' Middle East oil supplies, block off Allied aid to the USSR, isolate British armies in the Middle East, and bring a junction of the German and Japanese forces somewhere in Asia, sealing the Allied fate. And again, that revolt had Khairullah al-Tufah in its midst. Concluding, once again bearing in mind the concept of the Earth Island, the Grand Mufti's address to the World Muslim Congress in 1951. In February of 1951, the Grand Mufti suddenly reappeared in Karachi, Pakistan, to meet old friends who had supported his cause in Iraq and to preside over a 12-day World Muslim Congress. In a typical inflammatory address, he called for a full struggle by the Muslims to meet the aggressor, meaning in this instance the non-Muslim Hindus of India. He assured the delegates, quote, We shall meet next with sword in hand on the soil of either Kashmir or Palestine, unquote. There will be a detailed and annotated description of For the Record 369 in the For the Record section of the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. There are also links to two websites in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Those websites are maintained, two websites maintained by sister station WFMU. More recent programs are streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. There's a longer URL with For the Record programs for download only. This concludes For the Record program number 369, either Kashmir or Palestine, being recorded on July 15th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.